to Cinemaker, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 8, Out of Sight, from 1998. I'm Mike Manzi.
I'm Tobin Addington.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And what we were just saying before we started recording is, at least Tobin and I have only seen this movie once. I'm not sure how many times Mike has seen it, but like, we don't know why we're not watching this movie like every week or every month. Like, it's so good and so fun. And even though it's 2 hours, it flies by. This movie's just wonderful.
Yeah, no, and I have to correct you right away. I've seen this movie a lot more than once, but I was agreeing with you on the fact that as I watch it, I say, why don't I watch this every day?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm right there with you guys. I hadn't seen this movie for about 10 years, which is a sin. I don't know why it's not in constant rotation as well, but I was there in theaters. I actually had to drag two friends, two very good friends, mind you, to go see this. And afterwards, they apologized for being so stubborn and stupid and thanked me for making them see this movie. And since I've seen it a bunch of times, but not in a while. So it was really good to watch it again.
So when you're listening to this, this was months and months ago, but sort of recently as we're recording this, there was that thing floating around the internet of pick your favorite movie from each year you were alive. And I picked this movie for 98 sort of out of just like vague memories of really liking it. And also because 98, at least of what I've seen, was not a great year for movies, I don't think. And when my friend was looking at the list, she said, you have a Jennifer Lopez movie on your favorite movies list. And I was like, you need to see this movie because she is perfect in this movie. I mean, say what you want. I mean, I liked her music, you know, when I was in middle school or whenever she was on VH1 and MTV and whatever, on TRL. I like her as sort of like a personality, but I mean, she is so, so good in this movie. And everybody is so good in this movie in capturing the Elmore Leonard life force or whatever, because pretty much all of his books and movies and TV shows, like Jackie Brown and Get Shorty and the Justified TV series and a whole bunch of other stuff, they all feel similar in that they feel real and they're like perfect, like, you know, they're movie characters, but they're also feel like real people, and everybody embodies that, like, I think from top to bottom.
Yeah, I think everyone's really putting on great performances here. Everyone's at the top of their game. I mean, not just Soderbergh as a director. I mean, you mentioned this movie is 2 hours, but it flies by. The pace is perfect. It moves around in time, but never gets confusing. J-Lo's great. You know, she was never ever really on my radar, so I mean, I was always confused as to why, you know, there was such a dislike to her and stuff, but like her movies like Made in Manhattan and things, like, they're just, you know, not my cup of tea. So I never had an impression of her, but I love her in this. It almost feels like this movie was like tailor-made for her at times, or her and Clooney. When you find out like you got them together, it's like, okay, let's do everything to sort of accentuate what's great about these two. But somewhere between like Jackie Brown and Get Shorty for me, where it's got serious down-to-earth moments like Jackie Brown, but it also has sort of these dark, comedic, funny moments like Get Shorty, which are just sort of these absurd situations you find yourself in and need to talk your way out of, act your way out of, just get yourself out of these criminal situations. So yeah, I was really, I'm really pleased with sort of like the balance of this movie all around. I think that's why it works so well.
Okay, it's time for me to make a controversial statement.
Uh-oh.
I think this might be a perfect movie.
Okay. No, I don't, that's, I mean, no, that's fine.
Well, I feel like as I'm watching it, I've sort of always had this feeling with this movie, like, I don't know what I would change. You know, we spend a lot of time on these podcasts talking about how we would change things or things we wish were different or, and not as, you know, every time a new scene comes up, I think, oh, great, this scene. And then, you know, and then a new flashback will come up and I'll say, oh, great, this flashback. There's never a moment in this movie that I'm not entirely with it. I don't think there's a performance in this movie that doesn't work. Down to the bank teller in the opening scene, who's apparently a local actress that they found where they were shooting, like all the way up to the these movie stars who have probably never been better, and in some cases were never this good again. I think there's a difference between a perfect movie and a capital G great movie. I think there are some, you know, great movies that aren't perfect, and perfect movies don't have to be great, but I wouldn't change a single thing about this movie. I think it might be perfect.
I mean, I have no disagreements there. Because I feel like when you say the word, not you specifically, but like when people talk about perfect movies, I think like I think Perfect Movie could be, like, a lot of different things. Like, I'm not comparing this movie to that, but, like, Shoot 'Em Up is maybe, like, a perfect movie, because, like, it's exactly what it wants to be. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to be a good movie. It could be a bad movie. But, like, if you are 100% nailing what you want to nail, then it's perfect. Like, there's nothing... Like, exactly what you said. Like, so I think that there could be... I mean, in theory, every movie could be a perfect movie. I mean, that would be great. Wouldn't that be amazing? But this is perfect, I think. But what's also kind of not scary per se, but interesting to think about is when we talk about all these different movies, I look at the IMDb trivia of like the movie that it almost was or whatever. Soderbergh didn't originally want to direct this. He had some other project he was trying to get going. And then the head of Universal, Casey Silver, called him and was just like, you should do this. He's like, I don't know. He's like, no, like, you should do this. And he read the script. He liked the script. He wanted to work with George Clooney. And so, like, he convinced him. He finally got the job. But, like, Soderbergh almost wasn't involved. And then after he got involved, they were close to casting Sandra Bullock as the lead. And he said that they had really good chemistry, which we would see later in Gravity, but he felt it wasn't right for an Elmore Leonard movie. Mm. And then Catherine Keener, who is perfect in her role here, she was almost Karen Sisko. She was almost a Jennifer Lopez part. And so there's all these like slight permutations of like what could have been. And I'm sure there's, you know, this is true of every movie, but I'm sure there's way more for this movie that we don't even know about. But those things that you can just sort of significantly alter what is otherwise, you know, there's no wrong choices here, and you just sort of like it almost makes you appreciate, not almost, it definitely makes you appreciate when a movie nails everything, when you're like, well, Sandra Bullock is great, but like I don't know if she could do what Jennifer Lopez did.
Yeah, you're right. There's a real special alchemy to this movie. There's a special alchemy to all the performances, not just working on their own, but working with one another, to the structure of it, to the way it's all put together, to the look of it, to the way the camera moves, the way it's edited with those freeze frames, and all those things work so perfectly in sync that if you changed one of them, it wouldn't maybe make it a bad movie. I'm sure, you know, Catherine Keener would be great as Karen Sisko. But there's a real sort of special magic that comes when all the elements seem to come together as well as they did here.
Yeah, the only actor throughout this who I thought maybe you could swap out was Steve Zahn for Sam Rockwell, only because he sounded so much like Sam Rockwell. And they are sort of similar in style, I feel. But that was it, really. I mean, Albert Brooks is basically, I forgot he was in this movie until he had his toupee on. Like, I forgot he was the bald guy in prison, the sad sack. Don Cheadle, like, really scary in this. Yeah, I remember watching this and not knowing Don Cheadle and, you know, wondering if they got, like, a real criminal to play his role or something. I was like, that guy is frightening.
Yeah, especially, like, right now as I'm watching The Wire, I'm like, he could really fit in with, like, that show. Like, that is, you know, and The Wire is maybe the best casting of criminals ever. And, like, Don Cheadle in this movie is right on par with that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I mean, there's just like a whole vibe here that's working too. And I wonder what Soderbergh brought to this might have been sort of the like the camera style, like not just the editing sort of freeze frames, but I noticed that it's shot almost like in that docu style. I mean, you see a lot of it now, not done this well. It's usually overdone, like over shaky handheld camera stuff. But here, it's like it's almost like people are spying on the characters in the movie at times. I don't know. I just got a really cool sense of how he shot the film. It felt very on the fly. It felt very fly on the wall. And it just had like a really fun, fresh sort of feel to it that fit this type of movie really well.
Another thing he's responsible for in some ways is the structure of the movie. So this is written by Scott Frank. So he may be my favorite living screenwriter.
And he just wrote Logan.
Yeah, totally. Right. He works with James Mangold sometimes. Yeah, yeah. And Soderbergh is producing his six-hour Western for Netflix called Godless, starring Jeff Daniels, which is going to come out next year.
Oh, okay. That whole Logan Western connection and him being attached makes a lot more sense.
Totally. I think there's been some set photos coming out from that are pretty great. Anyway, so he's with the writer on this movie from the very beginning, and he'd written Get Shorty, a known quantity as far as Elmore Leonard stuff goes. And earlier in the process of developing it, he had this sort of nonlinear structure, this flashback structure. Not quite the way it is here, but there were flashbacks involved. And then some point along the way, Barry Sonnenfeld was going to direct it. And they took the flashbacks out and told the story straight, linear, A to B to C. And that's the version of the script that Soderbergh got. Okay, so there is a case to be made that Soderbergh reads that script and says to him, you know what? Have you ever thought about doing this non-chronologically? And Scott Frank says, as a matter of fact, I did. And then they, you know, go back to that version. And if that had not happened, it's entirely possible the straight ahead version would have landed in some director's lap who would have shot it that way. And it would have been fine, but it would not have anywhere near the sort of resonance and power. I think, as we remember from last week, Soderbergh's idea is, right, that every movie starts with one basic aesthetic choice. And I think here that choice is to use the flashbacks to make this nonlinear structure, let the film sort of catch up with itself. And that then sort of feeds out into everything else in this movie. And I think that that's such a brilliant choice here.
My goal before we talked about this, I wanted to read the novel because I'd never read the novel before. I only read the first 50 pages. So it's like the first like sixth of it or whatever.
I read it when I was in high school. So
the book starts out with the prison break, which we don't see for a little bit in this movie. And it sort of like, you know, comes back, and it doesn't really come back and forth, but like that's where we get. But here in the beginning, there's a little bit before like him robbing the bank, which we never actually, maybe it comes back later in the book, but like it's more action as opposed to just, like it seems like the, what's on screen is really closely adapted from the novel. Like him, you know, watching the guys running around the track, him talking to them, him sort of alerting the guard, meeting the guard in the chapel, knocking the guard out, then escaping. Like, that's all pretty much beat for beat what happens in the novel, but that's how it starts. Here, we get a little bit more excitement. We see him as his professional bank robber. I was also imagining, you know, you said, like, that perfect casting of that local bank teller. Like, can you imagine getting robbed by a guy as handsome as George Clooney? Like, just take all my money. Like, here, I'm sorry. Like, here's all my money. But I like that jumping around, and, like, we get the flashback of, like, 6 weeks earlier, 6 weeks later, or 2 years earlier, or whatever, and it does a great job of, like, perfectly at the right time and with the right amount filling in the backstory that you need to know. And if you did everything chronologically, I feel like you wouldn't be into the action as much, and you also, it would be paced poorly, I think, because by adding in those flashbacks, you add in excitement to, like, a place where you're sort of just moving the plot forward, kind of, right?
Well, and you wouldn't get, apparently in that other draft, you didn't meet Karen, you didn't meet J-Lo for 35 minutes into the movie. So here you're getting her with her dad, you're sort of getting to know who she is, and there's some sort of understanding of who they are when they end up in the trunk together, which is kind of the big moment early in the movie. And I think that's those sort of decisions are pretty vital here. We should say just very briefly, for those of people who have not seen the movie, that it follows this bank robber played by George Clooney in and out of prison and sort of then going on one last heist, that sort of traditional thing. And he falls for a federal marshal played by Jennifer Lopez, and they end up with this sort of like, they can't be together, but they'd like to be together, but maybe they are together, but they're not really together throughout the course of the movie as she's hunting him or not. So it sort of leaves that up in the air sometimes. But that's sort of then the movie is as much about them and about relationships and about deciding what to do with the second half of your life as it is about the action of robbing banks or whatever.
Yeah, and I feel like that is the part of the story that's told in the present tense for the most part, right? Like,
right,
And I think that's why maybe if this was told in more of a linear fashion, it would work less because we would lose a lot of that because I feel like we would spend too much time in prison.
Right.
All the flashbacks are basically in prison, and to space all that out really helps digest it. And also, he does something interesting where he'll talk about a character in the present, and then in the flashback, we'll see a character like Steve Zahn show up, and then we'll see him, how they met in prison, or, you know, we'll hear about Don Cheadle, and then we'll see him. So they do cool things like introduce characters in a cool way in the flashbacks. Like, they're used as a storytelling device. You know, he's actually revealing information that just would feel almost out of place if it was told straightforward. I don't recall from the book exactly what fashion it's told in back and forth, but I do like how he does clever things here too, like color coding the jumpsuits in the different prisons to let you know which one you're in, and so he's very good at keeping you oriented as he's jumping back and forth and all over the place.
Another thing in terms of the structure, we talked about on the King of the Hill episode how there was like that maybe non-linear editing, there was that great video essay, and we sort of talked about it in a few past episodes, and it's going to come up a lot more in future movies. And I think it comes up, if I recall, I haven't seen it in a while, but I should remember because I've seen it so many times, definitely similar to the Ocean's movies. Yeah. And because I've only seen this movie once, maybe I was just sort of soaking it in the first time, I really did not put together how similar this is in look and feel to those movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the same composer. It sounds very similar. It's got the same kind of playful attitude. Mm-hmm. I mean, Clooney is great in both, obviously. I kind of think that he's, like, almost the same character or very similar character. They're both, you know, they're both thieves.
Yeah, it's like a big warm-up to Ocean's.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, because that's going to be, I think, 3 years after this. And so this is obviously the first of many George Clooney collaborations with him and Soderbergh. But this movie feels like sort of like a prequel or like a sister movie or something to the Ocean's movies in tone, in style. I mean, if Ocean's 11 was rated R instead of PG-13, I think it could be really even like way closer to this. But that's sort of like a more, slightly more family friendly, a little bit more fun caper than this. But they're close, and I love that.
Yeah, totally. The DNA is here, right? This is the seeds of all that to come. I think even if people did not know directors and you showed them this movie, that they would say, "Oh, that's like Ocean's 11." Like that would be it would be pretty clear, I think. The relationship also between Soderbergh and Clooney is kind of fascinating, which begins with this movie. The way I understand it is that it's been a while since I read or heard the commentary or whatever taught me this, but that Soderbergh was really impressed with Clooney's notes as the dailies were coming in, as cuts were coming together. Right? He would say that Clooney's notes about the movie, his suggestions about how to change it or how to fix it, were like a producer's and were spot on. And he really valued his opinion. And then Clooney has talked about how, and other actors talk about this too, that Soderbergh broke him of some of his bad acting habits or his crutches. There's a thing that if you watch any old ER episode or a lot of Clooney before this, that he very often has this thing where he sort of puts his head down and looks over his eyebrows and smiles. It's like a charming thing. I think anybody who spent any time in the 90s watching George Clooney knows that look. And it's something that Soderbergh very definitively told him, don't do that, George. Just look. And in this movie, you see from that opening scene, he just stands and looks. His eyes are open. You know, he does that very little in here and retains all of the charm, but it changes his performance in some interesting ways. I think that they both sort of found something in one another that they liked. And then, so they then put together this production company, and all of Soderbergh's movies for the next, you know, 10 or 12 movies are made under this Section 8 banner, this company that they formed together. And it produced other things with the movie Pleasantville and a bunch of other some indie movies that they made together. But anyway, it all sort of starts with this and opens up a really, really fertile period in both of their careers.
Yeah, I remember around this time that Clooney wasn't really hitting too hard as a box office star. Like, I think he had that Nicole Kidman movie when they were chasing a nuke. He had some movie where he lost his kid with Michelle Pfeiffer in New York City.
One Fine Day, yes. Mm-hmm.
These all sound like Nicolas Cage movies.
It was, he would have probably been better in them, but I just remember Dusk Till Dawn was not like a mainstream success, but it was very popular in my circle. We love that movie. But
real quick aside, sorry about it, from Dusk Till Dawn. The mugshot of Clooney on the front of the newspaper is of Seth Gecko from Dusk Till Dawn. So they just took that from that movie.
Funny.
And stuck it in here.
That's
so
funny.
I mean, he's really good at playing really nice bad guys. Like, there's something about his charm that adapts well into being like a bank robber or a thief or something like that too. But I really feel like he was almost not like he was never gonna not make another movie again. But as far as making another good movie, I feel like this was almost like pulling him back and saying, like, no, like, Clooney is viable. Like, Clooney, you know, is a true movie star. Like, he just needed the right usher to help him, like, get there. And I feel like Soderbergh really elevated him to that level to show, like, everyone else, like, oh, yeah, Clooney, like, deserves to be there. He's not just getting by on his looks or anything.
Well, I read one thing that said Clooney was attracted to this role because when he was little, he always admired, like, in thief and heist movies, he always admired the bank robbers. And he always wanted to play those roles where, like, you root for the bad guy and you want the bad guy to get away. And so I think that comes across perfectly here. And also in the Ocean's movies, that, like, yeah, he's on the wrong side of the law both times, but, like, god damn it, he's charming, and, like, you have to root for him.
Yeah, he's the perfect man. Foley is the perfect guy. I mean, he combines sort of goofiness with sexiness, with street smarts, with some cunning, with some idealism, and I don't know, but without all of it, without being too much. This character, and then you're totally right to say that Danny Ocean could be the pseudonym. Maybe that's who he becomes after he escapes in the end of this movie
with Samuel L. Jackson at the
end. Yeah. Maybe that there's a whole thread here we're gonna discover as we go along. And Don Cheadle's character has a twin brother who was raised in England. Who knows? But you can definitely see how for what Soderbergh offered Clooney was a chance to get some cred, because Soderbergh is this art house darling director, and then Clooney offers Soderbergh some star power, and together they make their first movie that is both sort of critically lauded and financially successful in a while. So it sort of jumpstarts them both in a way. They both get something very, very good out of it, and sort of allows them to continue in as you say, this new trajectory, right? Like Soderbergh had not made a studio movie that had been very successful before this. And Clooney had been making these, The Peacemaker, One Fine Day, and he'd been trying to find himself as a movie star after having been a TV star, and then you know, leaving TV for movies and not having, you know, and having had some real trouble with it. And I think this sort of revitalized both of them.
So this movie was made for $49 million, and it made worldwide like $77 million. So I mean, it made money probably. I mean, it didn't make a ton of money, but considering the underneath cost, a couple million, and like Schizopolis cost $250,000 to make or whatever. I mean, this was a big movie and probably made money, definitely kickstarted both their careers.
And on DVD, it came out in the height. I think I said last time, this is the first DVD I bought. And it came out at the height of DVDs. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but my memory is that it would have made about that back on DVD. It made a ton of money on DVD.
Well, that's good. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, my copy is from way back when it first came out, too, on DVD. So, yeah, I've had it ever since then, sitting on the shelf.
He also, Soderbergh had this thing that, it's not exactly what you're talking about, but he had a quote that said, "It doesn't seem greedy to make a movie once every 9 years that people show up to go see. If I'm the cinematic equivalent of The Locust, it seems like I'm coming up on the time. And if so, that's great, because then I'll be able to coast for another 8 years and make some more interesting movies." And so I do like that he's even self-aware that, I mean, he knows that these last 5 or 6 movies or whatever we've done since Sex Lies have made no money. I mean, they really, in the end, haven't cost money. Like, he's probably broken even, or, you know, even if not, he knows that the amounts that these studios are paying for these movies are insignificant. Like, it doesn't matter. But here is finally another movie that people are actually interested in. And, you know, between now and Oceans, like, we keep talking about Oceans, but we have The Limey and Aaron Brockovich and Traffic. And Traffic is going to be, you know, a Best Picture, and Aaron Brockovich is a big movie. And, like, so he's not going to go another 8 years of coasting. He's going to, like, stay in, for the most part, like, stay in this, like, Hollywood, but like still fun Hollywood, yeah. like a movie that's fun to make and also fun to see.
Yeah, I always find that he has this amazing ability to be like so practical. Like, his outlook is just like, he's not like delusional at all about what he does. It just feels to me like he understands like his own position. He likes making like all kinds of movies, but realizes like it's a job, and in order to sort of play around in that field, you have to, you know, please your boss every once in a while. And I think what ends up happening is that his sensibilities with that sort of idea of I've got this time to coast, I'm free to do what I want and explore, is sort of going to align with what the studio is looking for, or at least catches the studio's attention in a way where they're like, well, Aaron Brockovich, like, what? Like, you know, you want to do this about, like, small town poisoned water, but Julia Roberts, and, you know, it becomes a performance piece, and it becomes a mainstream success, and then he goes on to Traffic. It's just interesting how it seems like mentally he's like free of certain shackles of doubt to a degree when he puts himself in a mindset of like, okay, Out of Sight will get me some time to explore, and then that freedom in his exploration, he'll find things that make a lot of money or will become successes and won't become like the next Kafka or something like that.
This movie, for lack of a better word, is very sexy. Entertainment Weekly named this the sexiest movie of all time.
Wow.
In November 2008, so it wasn't like a recent thing, like it was 10 years after this came out, they named it the sexiest movie ever. And number 2 was His Girl Friday from 1940. So, you know, you have to go 58 years in between. Also, Movie Phone that same year, I don't know what 2008 was doing like with like sexy lists, but Movie Phone that same year ranked the top 25 sexiest movie couples, and this is number 4. And just like thinking about that, thinking back to the movie, like there's that one scene where they're at the bar and Clooney is with Ving Rhames and the whole, all the, you know, marshals are after them, and they're going up to his his hotel room, and they just miss him in the elevator, and then, like, he sees Jennifer Lopez in the lobby and waves to her, and then, like, she goes back to the hotel, and he goes there, and, like, there's all those in-from-out-of-town businessmen hitting on her because she's a beautiful woman drinking alone, and then I just think, like, Clooney shows up, and it's just like, how is Adam from wherever bumfuck, like, gonna ever compete with George Clooney? Just, like, shows up. And what I also love, and I know I'm sort of all over the place, but there's a few things, there's probably many things, things I just didn't even, like, make a note of, but there's a few things at least that are, like, set up early in the movie that pay off later. Like, for the one thing is when they're in prison, they find out about the fish, and then the uncut diamonds are in the fish tank. Or here, like, we see Clooney playing with his lighter and playing with his lighter and playing with his lighter, and then we have him go up to the table that she's sitting at, and we don't see who it is, even though we know who it is, but we just see him, like, flicking his lighter. And, like, that's such a perfect, like, equating that action or that item with that character, and it's like, that is, we know that person.
Yeah, I was a smoker at the time of this, and I definitely went out and, like, got a Zippo and thought it was George Clooney for a couple weeks, and then when that ran out of fuel, I think it just went on in the drawer somewhere.
Yeah, this is a really sexy movie. And what's interesting is that the actual love scene in the movie between the two of them starts in the hotel, as you're saying, in the hotel bar, and they're sort of playing characters, right? They're pretending they're Celeste and, is it Gary? Is Celeste? Is that what they come up with fake names for one another?
Yeah.
Themselves. And it's so beautifully cut that partway through that conversation, we start getting cuts of them returning to her hotel room, and then back to the conversation, and then back to them in the hotel room as they start to move toward the bed and everything. And he touches, you know, puts a hand on her thigh, and then back to putting his hand on her glass in the bar. And so you end up with this, like, their flirtation sort of folds in with the act itself. And then there's this great pair of shots, a medium shot of him and a medium shot of her, as they're taking off their clothes across the bed from one another.
They're both just so beautiful.
They're beautiful, but also, they're also being funny. They seem a little uncomfortable, not in a bad way, but like, we've never done this before. Like, these characters are going to have sex for the first time, and like that's an awkward feeling. Is awkward, maybe it's more than uncomfortable is a better word. And then equal parts erotic, and they're not showing a ton of skin, you know? Like, this is not a sex scene that involves naked bodies flailing around. But I think because of who the characters have been and how charming the actors are, and then the way this scene is cut together with this, you know, sexy music and the digital snow falling outside, and then intercut with the flirting scene, and we've wanted them to get together the whole movie. Like, we've been waiting for this the whole movie, and then so when it finally happens, it's adult, it's funny, it's erotic, it's awkward, it's, it can be all of those things together. And you don't often find, I think, in American studio movies, sex portrayed both so positively and so realistically. And I think that makes it, to my mind, even sexier than something that's sort of perfectly lit and it's just like, you know, boobs flying around or whatever. Like, this really, I think this gets at something very real, which I think makes it sort of stick in my mind anyway.
And it's also just, like you said, it's super funny that, like, the next morning when they wake up, and she's getting dressed and he, like, pats the bed for her to come back and she just doesn't come back. Yeah. It's like, how are you going to turn him down? But what I think is, I'm pretty sure this is true. I read this on IMDb. I didn't read this out of Soderbergh's mouth. But supposedly the first scene he shot, and also the audition for J-Lo, like the screen test, was that trunk scene.
Yeah.
And so they apparently, all from IMDb trivia, so I don't know if this is right, but it feels right. It was sort of like a casting couch situation that Jennifer Lopez even made jokes about, that like they were at Clooney's house and they laid down on one of his couches and, like, did that scene to see what their chemistry was like.
Huh.
And so that was, I guess, how she got the job. And then he shot that first to have this, like, forced intimacy, because they do, like, they kind of fall in love there. I fall in love with both
yes,
of them there.
Yes.
I'm smiling that entire scene, because you can read it, like, that's part of the thing that I read in the novel is that scene. And, like, it's so good in the book, but then to see them bring it to life, like, it's, she's smiling and he can't see that she's smiling, but they're just, like, talking about old movies, and, like, they're just so in sync with each other. And he's like, you know, if we met another way, you know, and she's putting him down, but, like, she's also thinking, like, yeah, you're right. Like, they're just perfect. And, like, that whole scene is amazing. Like, their whole relationship throughout, even to the end when she gives him the lighter and then hooks him up with Samuel Jackson, who has escaped from 9 prisons or whatever, that, like, we're gonna get out because I'm gonna chase you down, but, like, we can have another one night. Like, what's 2 years in prison if, like, we can have one more night together? Like, they're both okay with that. It's just beautiful.
I like about that trunk scene is, like, it's really well shot for, like, a confined space too, and that's intimate and sexy with the grease and the dirt on her legs and the close quarters and all that kind of stuff. But what I feel from it is they just get each other. Like, they just instantly get each other. Like, the same sense of humor, same pop culture references. They even talk about a movie where they thought it was a little unbelievable how quickly the two leads fell in love. You know, and that's almost just like a nod to the audience saying, you know, you get it. Like, you're just supposed to believe that they fall in love at first sight. Like, you know, it's a movie. So, yeah, that's maybe my favorite scene in the movie. I mean, that is the scene of the movie to me, to be honest. Like, if you're going to say watch one scene, check that one out.
So the interesting thing about that scene, which is, this is no surprise if you've listened to the commentary or watched any of the making ofs, but the first time they shot that scene, Soderbergh's idea was to do that scene all in one take. And so it was them one shot on the two of them doing the entire 11-page scene, and apparently stopped the movie dead. Like, it just, they were great in it, but because the camera didn't cut anywhere, it just sort of tanked a hole in the movie. Because that's then, suddenly that's, you know, that's a big percentage of your movie.
Because it's a long scene.
Yeah. So they had to go back and reshoot it. That's the one main reshoot that they did for the scene, is to shoot a whole new, you know, whole new version of it and to be able to cut it all up. And the other thing is that the movie that they talk about in there is 3 Days of the Condor, the Sidney Pollack movie with Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway, which I have beat the drum on this and other podcasts with you guys for months now. So I urge you both to see it because it's very good. But in that movie, Robert Redford is sort of on the run and needs a car. And so he carjacks her. Like, he steals her car. So he's got her at gunpoint and makes her drive to her house and then spends the night with her there. And because he's a good guy, but he's on the run from, like, the hitman or whatever, CIA hitman. So it ends up being, it is a really mirror to this movie in a lot of ways, except that in that case, he's not a criminal, and whereas Clooney is. But anyway, you're right. That scene just sets everything up for them in the movie. And I would sort of love and hate to see a version of the movie with that long take in it. I just think this works so well. The cutting to the close-ups of his hands on her hips and to the outside of the trunk, and sort of, you get the sense that it's a long drive without having it feel long. And I think that it ends up being very, very powerful.
And what I also like as a sort of meta moment is that already at this point in Soderbergh's career, he had met with Sidney Pollack and sort of impressed Sidney Pollack and, like, brought him in as a producer. I think it was on that The Last Ship, that movie about the Russian submarine that he really wanted to make, and that sort of fell through. But I like that, you know, this sort of influential figure in his career. I don't remember if that's in the novel, because I remember they talked about Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid a lot. Like, they talk about it extended sort of in the novel. But I don't remember if 3 Days of the Condor is in there, but I like that, you know, it's another Sidney Pollack sort of reference, I guess? Like, sort of linking him and Soderbergh together a little bit deeper.
I think it's just another good understanding of the source material. Like, whatever they changed is negligible. Like, the only thing I can really tell from the book is the ending is different. Like, there are no diamonds, the house is empty, and they all get, you know, they get caught. Like, people are still getting shot and dying, but Foley gets caught the same way, and there's no scene at the end with the escort with Sam Jackson or anything. But for the most part, otherwise, it's like a really strong adaptation, and I think it's a testament to how well the original source material is written, too, is that on the page, these characters are so well realized, you can take them off the page and sort of change things, change ethnicities, change just certain little shifts and things, and it'll still work for the most part because the groundwork is so strong there. Did you guys catch that one moment? I didn't catch it until this time watching it, but I think it's when Karen is recovering from her sort of escape from Glenn, when she convinces Glenn to drive away and they crash. And I think it's also when Michael Keaton shows up. It's during that scene. He shows up as Ray Nicolette from Jackie Brown. But her dad is talking about how that Karen sort of did this before in a way. She fell for a guy. She was seeing a guy and then found out that he was, like, robbing stuff, and she had to shoot him in the leg and break up with him. So, like, I don't know, it just sort of this kind of, not hidden, but it's like this buried story about Karen's past, like a line that's dropped about her that just reinforces her attraction to Clooney too. It's like, she is a federal marshal, but she likes the bad guys. It's like part of what she's attracted to.
Well, that's what's great about, like, movies like, I think of Shaun of the Dead, where they basically give away the entire plot of the movie in that one conversation. Like, if you're listening and paying attention, know what's coming, like, this is all being laid out for you. Like, we know that she's going to fall in love with him and everything. That's just like a little cool moment. The Ray Nicolette character apparently was owned by Miramax because Jackie Brown had gone into production before this movie. And so Universal might have had to, like, pay for the character. I'm not exactly sure how all that works, but Tarantino said, no, you can have him for free. And so Michael Keaton came from Jackie Brown and did his character in this, like, for the one scene. He's great just wearing that FBI shirt. And, you know, he's asked, like, you know, do you ever walk around with a shirt that just says undercover? But he and Samuel L. Jackson both did their cameos in this movie for free. So that's cool. Like, I don't think, because they were both in Jackie Brown, so I guess, you know, just them sticking around. Although, Samuel L. Jackson's a different character in this than he was in Jackie Brown, right? So, not exactly, not quite a shared universe, I guess.
But again, was manufactured for the film, though. Was sort of just put in there. You know, so in the novel, Sam Jackson still just plays one character in the Elmore Leonard written universe.
Gotcha, okay.
I love this ending so much better than what sounds like is the ending of the book. Elmore Leonard endings are tough for me. I know what he's trying to do, and it works really well, I think, but I always am looking for a little bit more of a happier ending, which I feel odd saying because I'm not usually a person who's looking for it, but the characters are often sort of, you can see their fates coming and there's nothing that can be done, and then it happens and you're like, oh God, whether they live or die or get shot or whatever. But I like this, and maybe because I've just built up such goodwill for these characters, I don't mind that then you get this sort of like, oh, and here's this bank robber who's maybe going to set you free so that we can have a little more time together or whatever. I could see people looking at that scene and saying, okay, here's the scene that makes this not a perfect movie. But for me, I'm glad they have that in there.
Yeah, I think that what also makes it like a good adaptation is like they knew what to change and what not to change. You know, like they have that, the essence of everything is within that scene. It feels like something that could have been in the novel, you know, so it's not completely out of place or out of character. It's a nice, just like an extra coda for you if you've read the book and then you go see the movie. It's like, oh, here's something not in the book that still works and expands the story in a way that you want it to, as opposed to like leaving you on a cliffhanger that you wouldn't want. Like, this is exactly the kind of ending like I feel like this film deserves, right? Like, you're reading the book and you're like, this book needs one more scene.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I like, because I mean, in Justified, in the TV series, I don't know if you guys have seen that, or I don't know if you read the Fire in the Hole. It's a short story that he wrote. It's in this collection of short stories. And at the end of the short story, Boyd Crowder, who, like, the whole short story is like, you know, Raylan Givens, who in the TV show is Timothy Oliphant, is chasing this guy, Boyd Crowder, who is played by Walton Goggins, the TV show. And they used to dig coal together, so they have, like, this shared history, but they're on different sides of the law. Sort of, you know, the same thing here. Like, it's all about cops and criminals and all of Elmore Leonard stuff. And in the short story, Raylan kills Boyd. Like, he shoots him in the chest and he dies. But when they cast Boyd for the TV series, Walton Goggins was so good that they're like, oh, we're gonna have him live. And he lived through the entire, until the end of the series. And because he's just so perfect. And that's like another thing that, like, it feels real. Like, I think in the show, he had like a Bible or something in his pocket, and like the bullet hit the Bible or something. I don't remember. It was something that, you know, fit into that world. But I like that, you know, ability to sort of roll with the punches, especially like when you have something like, you know, that Elmore Leonard would be okay with. I think that it's like the end of this, like, you know, the final scene in this movie fits perfectly, you know, this character arc of Boyd, and like Elmore Leonard worked with the people on Justified until Elmore Leonard died. Like, it feels all part of the story. And then, like, what's sort of weird is like they retrofitted it so that, like, they wrote future Raylan stories, or Elmore Leonard wrote future Raylan stories that Boyd's just alive in. So, like, it sort of like changed the future to like fit the TV series or whatever. But I like that. Like, you can change things if they feel natural, yeah. And here it does, and I'm totally okay with that.
It's definitely organic to the story. For sure. And what's another interesting moment in this movie is when everything shifts to Detroit. Halfway through this movie, we go to Detroit, and the color palette changes. We get a lot of these gunmetal blues, and there's a great sequence of where we're introduced to the city for the first time, and a car is just driving around. We're sort of seeing the sights of the city, and the pace feels different. And apparently that was like Soderbergh hanging out of a car, just driving around in a really cold day, like capturing shots. But, and the movie gets much more violent after that. Like, it's not that by any means that there's been no violence before this. People have been stabbed, and like people have been beaten. But when you get past, move past this and into Detroit, and you get John Cheadle character outside of prison on the loose in the real world, and his henchmen, Fatboy Bob and the Isaiah Washington character, who are like in their own ways sociopaths, and things get like really, really dark. And I think that that's, or not really, I shouldn't say really dark, but they get very, very dark. And I think that it's a wonderful sort of way to remind us that, like, even though this has been funny and there's a romance at the heart of this, like, people could and will really get hurt, and that the stakes are very high.
Yeah, we are suddenly Glenn, right? Like, we are trapped in the backseat of the car with Snoop and his cohorts, and...
Don't call him Snoop.
Oh, yeah, it's Mad Dog. Well, I guess he doesn't throw those fights anymore now that he's out. But, you know, I said it before, like, Don Cheadle scares the shit out of me in this movie, and yeah. He doesn't really have to do all that much. He's just super, like, confident and imposing, and, like, the character just gets what he wants, you know? Like, he just assumes... He owns everything anyway. He's like, this is my car. You find a new car. But it's kind of funny because Soderbergh did something in that moment that I wasn't expecting to have happen, which was empathize with Glenn. Like, up until that point, he's been treated as, like, you know, a pain in the ass, like a motor mouth guy who usually falls asleep at the wheel or whatever. Like, he'll blow the heist, and this is all his big idea, is to go rob Albert Brooks of all of his diamonds. But he is quickly getting, you know, like, bullied out of this entire score, and it's just funny in that moment where I feel for the guy incredibly. I am that guy in that backseat. I want out of that car.
Yeah, and it's still funny, that scene is they're in the car and Glenn doesn't know, Steve Zahn doesn't know where they're going or what's going on, and then he gets the idea they're going to go, like, kill this, it's a cross-dresser, or is it a trans person? Is that who they're going to kill? What are they? I can't remember. Anyway, they're going to do some sort of, like, robbery homicide, and they're like, Mad Dog, Don Cheadle pulls out this bag of weapons and starts handing out, like, hatchets and shotguns, and then turns to Glenn and says, which one do you want? Do you want the Glock?
Or the 9.
Or the 9, yeah. And that's and Glenn's reaction to this is like, what the hell is going on? And then when it gets into the scene where they actually kill the person in the house, it's shot in a very abstract, you know, you could just see sort of stuck on Glenn's, a close-up of Glenn's face in slow motion as he's sort of watching this sort of horror show happen and losing his sunglasses and getting blood splattered on him. And it's not graphic, but it's terrifying and violent in the same way. Sort of like the way that the sex scene evokes sex as opposed to showing it. This evokes the sort of terror and horror and violence in a way that makes it, I think, even more scary than if we'd actually seen it happen.
Yeah, there's like a thing about that sex scene which is almost like the conversation is the intercourse, and they're intercutting the actual sex over it. And I almost feel like they could have done the same thing with this scene and the murder, but they get close where it's like them talking about it is like, I feel like I'm seeing it. They're like passing out, you know, hacksaws and hatchets and guns and stuff, and they're like, we're gonna go murder this guy with these things, and I'm just already picturing it in my head. I don't need to see it on screen happen. So when we get it, like, from Glenn's dazed and confused point of view, like, I feel like that's good because we've already seen it. Like, Soderbergh has made me visualize it without even knowing it, you know, or wanting to.
And what I like further about that is that Steve Zahn really just can't catch a break. That, like, he tries to sneak out of the club, and then all of a sudden, Karen Sisko's in the back seat, like, catching him re-stealing that car. And it's such a great parallel, I guess, or opposite to Clooney, that, like, every time Clooney sees Jennifer Lopez, he's just, like, it's perfect. Like, it's bliss. It's, like, it's love at first sight. And here, like, Steve Zahn just can't catch a break. That he's just trying to get out of town or get out of the club or whatever, and she's just there. So, like, it's funny to see, like, how opposite their reactions are. That, like, you know, Clooney and Steve Zahn are not necessarily two sides of the same coin, or they're not, like, enemies. We see that, like, Steve Zahn irritates him a little bit, at least with the sunglasses, but I like that sort of parallel or that comparison or what have you between the two, just with, like, what Jennifer Lopez means to each of them.
Totally. And as the movie moves into the second half and things get darker, everybody gets less funny. Which is not to say the movie isn't still funny and still in some ways very light in terms of having a light touch. Like, it's not hitting these themes really hard. But it becomes much more about the prospect of death and aging and these choices that you make. And do you go back to prison or not? And Glenn stops being funny. I mean, he's still funny. There's a scene where he's running away from this meeting that Don Cheadle is having with Clooney and Ving Rhames, and he sort of sneaks into this car and is hotwiring it as Jennifer Lopez shows up, and she says, you know, you're stealing this car. He says, I'm not stealing it. I can't steal it. I stole it last week, so I couldn't be stealing it now. And it's funny, but underneath that is this extreme desperation. Like, he is just desperate to get away from this situation and these people, and that's going to sort of play underneath the comedy. I don't remember from seeing this in the theater, but my guess is that people stop laughing out loud at this movie, but you still find it funny, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's still cool, you know? Like, it might not be, like, funny, but, like, everything is still really cool, and it is fun to watch, even if it's not being hilarious anymore. But it's set itself up, like, it's already been funny enough for me, you know? I've already had enough laughs, I feel. Like, it's kind of cool that now, when we're in Detroit, we're going to get a bit more serious and focus on the actual crime, and we're going to, they're going to do the sleep together scene, so we have that happening, and then most of the time they spend is in the actual the heist, like actually robbing the mansion. You know, I feel like that third act is like mostly takes place in that house. So it is a 2-hour movie. It's not like they get right to it, but it feels like we're here already. You know, we're already like we're jumping out of this truck and we're gonna go rob this house.
I made a note early on that Karen Sisko reminds me of Hit Girl from Kick-Ass, if Hit Girl grew up, because they both like these, like, brutal weapons as birthday presents. Like, how many movies do you have? I mean, not to be stereotypically sexist, but I think that's also kind of the point of this. It's sort of like a gender-swapped, I think we talked about maybe last week, about, like, damsel in distress, you know, femme fatale is Clooney, sort of, and this hard-boiled detective is Jennifer Lopez. So I like mm-hmm. it's on display here. But, like, how many times in a movie do you see a girl like Hit Girl or a woman like Karen Sisko get a gun or ask for a weapon for her birthday? Like, you know, this birthday gift she gets is the Sig Sauer pistol, or, you know, in Kick-Ass, Cage is talking about how, like, he's gonna get her a pony or whatever stupid stuff, or she's talking about, like, how she wants a pony, she wants a teddy bear, whatever, and then she's like, no, daddy, I'm just fucking with you, like, whatever, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like I could see Hit Girl sort of progressing down the line and becoming a Karen Sisko type when she's older.
Yeah, I definitely feel like this movie is absolutely playing with gender roles and things like that. I mean, even Luis Guzman and his boyfriend, you know, the two guys who plan the whole escape from jail. Like, first viewing, like, I didn't really catch it, but this time, definitely, I caught that they were gay together, but it just kind of didn't occur to me watching it the first time. And then even there's that shot of Clooney in the bathtub, you know, with a candle lit, and that's something you would generally see, like, Jennifer Lopez do in a movie, right? Like, that's what you would expect. But here we have the male lead taking a bubble bath, and in walks Karen Sisko on him fully clothed, you know? So they do a lot of stuff with switching up the gender dominance throughout the whole movie. I mean, even just her being a federal agent, and those ad exec guys like thinking that she's just, you know, that she's upset because she had some big account and they were upset because a girl showed up, you know, just like I feel like we get her perspective of sexism a lot more than other films because the girl is a very vital main character in the story.
And I also like that, you know, that the bubble bath scene is a sex dream of hers in the hospital, and like she can't even have that. Like it's just I like that little twist on it too.
Yeah, the character she reminds me of is a little bit Clarice Starling. There's a little bit of you know, a female federal agent who's sort of, the movie's not about the sexism that she faces, but it presents it pretty clearly, and I think that comes through here. They're very different characters. They're sort of they react differently, and the movie around them is very different. But I think that there's something of they would have a lot to talk about if you could put those two together.
Oh, another little moment. There's so many like little moments in this movie that are perfect, to use that word from the beginning, that it reminded me of a scene from The Nice Guys, which I have to think is maybe like an homage to this, possibly. It's when Ving Rhames and Clooney are at that motel, I guess, and Clooney's like reading the newspaper, or maybe it's a house. I think it's a house, maybe. And Clooney's reading the newspaper by that balcony, and Ving Rhames like throws him something, and Clooney just lets it go right by him. That, like, in The Nice Guys, when they're like in that shootout, Russell Crowe tosses Gosling his gun, and like it just goes right out the window. Like, I just love that obliviousness, that like you're in a moment, like you're in the middle of something, and not everybody is like a cool, calm, collected movie character. That Clooney is like reading about Karen, like thinking about Karen Sisko, whatever he's doing. Maybe he's looking at her wallet and just doesn't even see the thing come at him. So like, I just like little moments like that are just, you know, make me laugh out loud.
And that's a moment that came up in rehearsal. That wasn't in the script. That's something that they did as they were rehearsing the movie that then they kept for the movie. But you're totally right. It says so much about Clooney in that moment and about his fixation on her and his real humanity. You know, like he's just, Buddy has to sort of coax it out of him that he's, you know, infatuated with this woman and going to try and see her again. And, you know, there's this real charm that the two of them have with one another, a real love to add to the love stories in this movie. But you're right. That is a great part. And Soderbergh talks in the commentary about that always getting the biggest laugh of the first part of the movie, the first section of the movie, outside of the Steve Zahn scenes. And you can see why.
And then, like, there's another moment like that a little bit later when Karen Sisko is at Catherine Keener's place. And Catherine Keener, I don't think I've ever seen her in a movie up to this point. Like, she's not young. She's, like, 40 here, but she seems like a baby in this movie. Like, she looks so much younger than, like, everything I've seen her in since that I was like, oh, like, okay. But she's, I think, like, 39 or something? Or maybe she's either 30 or 40. I think, like, she's older than she seems. But anyway, there's the scene where Karen Sisko goes there to talk to her to try to find out where George Clooney is. And Luis Guzman shows up and Karen Sisko says, tell him he has to wait in the hallway because you have to get dressed. And she says, you have to wait in the hallway until you get dressed.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. She's just dumb. Like, it's just a dumb character. And it made me laugh. Like, it's just this little thing that she doesn't know. Like, I understand she's nervous in the scene, but like, she's just so oblivious to like what's going on. And it's just like little like lines like that. And again, perfect casting. She just sells it.
You know, another person that surprised me that I totally forgot was in this movie until I saw her again was Viola Davis, who shows up as Isaiah Washington's, is she his sister or his girlfriend or his wife?
Oh, I didn't even recognize her.
Yeah,
okay.
And she's going to be in three or four other Soderbergh movies and sort of Soderbergh adjacent movies over the next stretch of things until she really gets a big part in Solaris. But she's great in this, you know, you can, it's always easy to in retrospect, see someone who's a Oscar-winning actress now and look back and say, oh, of course she was so great in everything. But she really is. She's really great in that moment. Has just a few lines, but but sells that part for sure.
Yeah, that is just another really, I felt like a really threatening scene too, but nothing is really happening. Soderbergh just had a real ability to create tension. Like, maybe it's just people aren't aware that Karen is an agent, you know? So you're almost on edge because you know someone's going to read the situation incorrectly and test her, and she can beat your ass, you know, basically, which is what ends up happening in that scene. Like, she's looking for Don Cheadle, and you're right, her relationship to Don Cheadle is very ambiguous, the Viola Davis character. I am not sure what's going on between the two of them. Maybe I was wondering if she was living in the drug house for him, you know, was sort of like living there, and it was just one of the places he hides stuff or something. But then when that other guy shows up, you know, talking about like wrestling with the female dog, you know, like clearly euphemisms for like I'm about to sexually assault this girl, like she's coming around just knocking on doors, and then he just gets like that nightstick and what I would assume would be like a broken arm. It was just great the way he takes you through that beginning to end with like such a sense of relief when you come out of that house.
Oh, speaking of, I didn't know that Viola Davis, I mean, I didn't know she was in this movie to begin with, but I also didn't know she was in other ones. Another Soderbergh-nection? Bergnection? I don't know. We'll figure it out. Is the bank customer, I think it's the guy talking to the manager, the assistant manager, or the associate manager. Even like that little like clarification, like, oh no, I'm sorry, like the manager's not in, that's the associate manager. He's like, Clooney's basically like, I don't care. Like you see that guy over there, right? That guy is Mike Malone, credited for some reason as Elgin Marlowe, but he played T. Azimuth Schwitters, the Scientology guy, in Schizopolis.
Right.
So, like, he's just like a Soderbergh friend. He's just like, hey, come on set for one day, meet George Clooney. You have one line. Like, he gets to touch you on the shoulder. Like, what's not to like?
There are Schizopolis actors all through this movie. The guy who's the security guard at the prison who gets knocked out by Clooney with the pot of flowers, he was Soderbergh's boss, who gives him the terrible writing assignment in Schizopolis. There are a lot of, partly because they shot some of the movie in Louisiana where they'd shot that movie. That was Louisiana, right? Where they shot,
Yep.
So they're back near Baton Rouge or in Baton Rouge, and so he's getting some of those people together too for this movie, which is, it's kind of fun to see those people show up.
To date, when this movie came out, this is the only movie to ever feature two Batmen.
Huh.
Oh, Michael Keaton. Yeah, they don't share the screen.
No, but they also both share a love interest in Jennifer Lopez, I guess. But now I guess with more Batman, like, you know, Christian Bale and Will Arnett Batman and Ben Affleck. Like, there's probably way more movies with two Batmen in it, but this was the first one. Elmore Leonard envisioned Jack Nicholson or Sean Connery as the George Clooney role?
Yeah, he's much older. Not much older, but he is older in the novel. He's more like the age of Karen's dad, I would say. You know, they aged him down a little bit in the movie.
And the last little note that I had was that in Brazil, this movie is called Irresistible Passion.
That's what I feel for this movie.
I don't have any other notes. I mean, I love this movie. I want to go watch it again right now. Like, I want to remember how much I love this movie. And I think having talked about it for an hour and we put this out and I re-listened to this episode, I will always hopefully remember how much I love Out of Sight because I love this movie.
I'm so glad. I thought you guys would like it or that, you know, you had liked it, but I am glad this could to be just a gush fest about this movie. I clearly love this movie too. This is one that if you have the time, the commentary on is fantastic because it's Soderbergh and Scott Frank, the writer, and they talk all through the history of the thing. And they break each other's balls and they talk about, they blame each other for stuff in a very sort of, you know, take the piss out of each other way. You know, it's really charming and very, very good. Soderbergh likes in his commentaries to have someone to talk to and not just be him, and this is one of the best. As we go through these Soderbergh movies, I'm keeping a list of, as I'm watching them, my favorites from, you know, favorite, most favorite to least favorite. And I'm just going to lay the marker down now and say this is going to be hard to beat. I'm not saying that it won't be or that it can't be. There are things I haven't seen. There are things that I haven't seen in a long time. You know, we have the Oceans movies still to come. I love Aaron Brockovich. I was a big fan of Traffic when it was out. So I don't know, but it's, as I say, it's a perfect movie in my book, and it's going to be hard to beat.
Yeah, it's my number one right now. I really wonder, as I was watching this movie, I was thinking about my list too, and I was just like, oh, like, is Ocean's 11 going to beat this? Because I don't think anything else will. Whoo, boy. We're going to find out in like 3 weeks.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Oh, actually, and, you know, by the time this comes out, we will have recorded almost all the Soderbergh episodes, so you'll probably be able to go on Letterboxd and see our complete rankings if you want to have a preview of what we think of movies. So
Yes.
That's exciting, ? Mike, do you have any other last thoughts about Out of Sight?
Two quick ones. So, eventually, at some point, there was a Karen Sisko TV show?
2003, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I never watched it. I just knew it existed, but I never watched it. But I thought that was kind of interesting that this character lived on television. And the other thing is that this movie introduced me to David Holmes, who did a lot of the music in this, who will go on and do a lot of the music in the Oceans movies, and is just like a really interesting producer. I liked a lot of his stuff back when I was DJ. Like, he just really interesting breakbeats and really cool music, and I really like the music in this. We didn't really mention it too much. You know, we go from throughout the movies, he usually works with the same composer, but I think he's kind of switched it up a little here. It sounds a little more groovier and a little less sort of
synthier.
Right.
It's perfect for this. The movie is, the music is perfect. To add one more thing to the perfect list.
Yep, and there's some funky bass lines in here too. But yeah, so I mean, just watch this movie. If you've seen this movie already, watch it again. Watch it again after that. I don't have anything else to say. I mean, I love Justified, but I feel like I have to give Justified the edge over this just because it's 6 seasons. Just because it's 6 seasons, it's like 70 or 80 hours of Elmore Leonard as opposed to 2, but you know.
Okay.
I love them both.
All right. Fair enough. There's room to love everything. We don't have to just love,
there is room to love
just
everything.
Just love one.
Does Ray Nicolette ever show up on Justified?
As far as I know, that doesn't really cross over, I don't think. But it's definitely worth watching. I used to be on Amazon. I think it probably still is on Amazon. It's great. So watch Justified. I like how, and they even talk about this, like, this is the third movie. We mentioned both earlier, like, Get Shorty and Jackie Brown, and this all came out between, like, 95 and 98, and they're all based on Elmore Leonard stories. They all have different tones, and they're all, like, sort of very different movies. And I just like that Elmore Leonard keeps having things adapted, and they all can sort of, like, they all feel similar, but they can also feel different, and I just love that. So for all things Cinemakers, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter and see all the episodes that we've done, see all the other shows on the network, and lots more fun stuff. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I am Tobin Addington.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.